Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Charlie Aitken, founder and chief investment officer of Aitken Investment Management. Charlie is undoubtedly one of the most well-known faces in the Australian investment landscape, having previously been the author of the widely read Ringing the Bell and Under the Southern Cross newsletters. In today's episode, we discuss why he's not worried about the trade war, why it's worth paying a premium for a high-quality growth business, and how he handled being long Boeing as the news broke of the 737 MAX 8 disaster in Ethiopia. Finally, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast, and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Patrick, thanks for having me.
It's great to finally be sitting down with you. As I'm sure a lot of the audience is already aware, you used to write Under the Southern Cross and the Ringing the Bell newsletters, which I think is a pretty unique and interesting background for a fund manager. So I'm curious, what would be the most unique lesson or experience that you took from writing your daily note, which has actually served you well as a fund manager?
Well, it's probably the communication piece. I think that, if anything, I was known for those 20 years for being a reasonably good communicator. Whether you were right or wrong on certain topics was, you know, probably secondary. I mean, it was about communication. I think with investors and running a fund, it's also about communication, making sure they're aware about what we own, what themes we're invested in, how we're performing. So to me, it's a communication piece. I enjoy communicating with investors and their advisors, and we do that on a very regular basis. So I suppose that's probably the main lesson I took away from it that has transferred into the funds management business.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll get a bit of insight into all that today and we can explore some of those ideas a little bit further. But first of all, why don't you give me a bit of an elevator pitch for your investment philosophy? Could you just briefly explain how you think about markets and where you think you gain your edge?
Yeah, I'm very simple. Look, I think if I've learned anything over the last 25 years, it's not to overcomplicate things. Try and keep the investment process and as simple as possible. My key elevator pitch, if you want to put it that way, is I want to own the best companies in the world in structurally growing sectors. So the best companies in the world in structurally growing sectors. I want the portfolio to try and reflect what the future looks like, not what the past looks like. And I will always pay a premium to the market multiple for companies that are growing structurally with great management and great market position. So best companies in the world, structurally growing sectors, concentrated portfolio would be the elevator pitch.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your time since you've transitioned to becoming a fund manager. Funds management, obviously a pretty challenging profession, I think. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. What are some of the interesting or difficult moments or challenges that you faced as a fund manager, and what do you think you learned, or how did it change you?
Well, it's been obviously an interesting process. It's a lot different between being a stockbroker or a stockbroker strategist and actually running people's money, looking after people's life savings, etc., etc. It comes with a real obligation. When I was writing notes, etc., etc., there's no overall scorecard for how you went. Hopefully, the record shows I had more good ideas than bad ideas, but there's no performance number, there's no risk management, there's no accountability as such. Well, that's completely different in asset management. There's very, very clear accountability in terms of you're judged on your performance and the risk you take. I suppose that, Patrick, look, for me, it was a difficult transition. Like, writing about money and running money are totally different things, completely different things. And, I've made some mistakes along the way, but I feel that I've really grown into it quite well now after 4 years. Now, we started with a small amount of money, $32 million, which I would call friends, family, coalition of the willing, including my own money. I sold my own house to put money in the fund. And here we are now at a few hundred million dollars, and we haven't done everything perfectly, but we've learned from our mistakes. So I've grown into it, and I'll tell you what the big difference is in my view. is in stockbroking, you need action. You're trying to generate activity to get paid. You need people to transact. In running money, I need to be more right than wrong, and I need to deal with problems quickly. You know, risk management's very, very important. So I've learnt that. And it's also, it's a long game. It is a long-term game. I'm trying to find companies that can grow over 3 to 5 years, not 3 to 5 minutes. And so there was quite a big adjustment. I feel that I sit in the seat well now, but I'd have to say the transition was not easy, but I feel confident in what we're doing now.
It's funny you mention, you know, that action is being a big part of being a stockbroker. It seems to me, based on what a lot of the fund managers who I've spoken to here on the show have told me, that inaction is almost a positive attribute as a fund manager, that you can make a lot of your money just by sitting tight and not getting too excited about what's going on at you know, with the latest volatility or the latest fads, or as it may be.
Yeah, look, I think that's absolutely right. And that's quite a big transition for me too. Like, you're used to sort of daily action, needing to make people transact and getting paid on transactions. Well, that's totally different when you're looking after people's money. The best day we have in the fund is when we do nothing. We don't transact anything. We don't change any holding. We don't buy or sell anything because we're well positioned. I think what's also happened, Patrick, is that like markets right now are a very level playing field. Everyone has the same information at the same time due to advances in telecommunications. So people who read Livewire have the same information as professional investors, which is fantastic. So for me, I don't think you make any money in the present. You make it by trying to predict the future and being accurately positioned for the future. So I spend the first, you know, 3 or 4 hours of the day not looking at screens, not reading broker research, but trying to read what I think is interesting in the world and try and formulate my views that way. So you're always trying to lengthen the tenure of the portfolio. So your comment that the best days are you doing nothing are absolutely right. You know, you can overtrade things. You really want to just simply hold the best things you can for the longest period you can. And that's right. So while there's a natural temptation to react to everything, the less you do is honest, it appears to be generate better returns.
You are one of the few fund managers around that both can and does invest actively both in Australia and overseas. I do occasionally see mandates that allow it, but it's actually pretty rare, I think, to see somebody who's accurately taking large positions both locally and overseas. So I guess my first question on that point is, how do you decide to split up your capital? Is it a top-down decision, a bottom-up decision, and what are the factors that go into deciding that?
Yeah, well, it's really the capital is allocated by conviction, where we can see the best returns over the next 3 to 5 years. So the opportunity set globally is obviously dramatically larger than Australia. You've got to remember that Australia is 2% of the world market and really is dominated by banks and resources. Now, the investors in my fund don't need me to buy them more banks and resource shares or Telstra or Woolworths or Wesfarmers. So we pretty much rule that out. I will buy an Australian stock if it's world leading, has a very large barrier to entry, and is growing at a multiple of GDP. But it has to be the best in its class in the world, and just happens to be listed in Australia. So our Australian holdings are very specific. There've been things like Aristocrat, A2 Milk, etc., which I would consider meet those guidelines. But we broadly leave Australia to investors to do themselves. We think the self-managed super fund world, where we look after money, generally can do Australia themselves. But I will hand pick a couple of companies that I think are world leading from Australia that fit our portfolio. At the moment, the Australian market, I'm struggling to find, you know, new ways of putting money to work. I think things are reasonably fully priced here, and the market's outperformed the world in recent times. The opportunity set outside of Australia, obviously in technology and the new growth sectors of the world, is dramatically larger. And I think the opportunity set outside Australia is actually stronger at the moment for medium-term returns. So we're focusing our attention mostly on the United States and mostly on China at the moment for different reasons. But at the end of the day, I don't have huge macroeconomic views necessarily about interest rates or oil prices or anything like that. I try to work out what goods and services people will buy more of in the future, and whether those companies that are selling those goods or services can charge higher prices and generate higher profits. I believe you buy companies that grow, and that's how you compound in the share market. So the vast bulk of that growth is outside of Australia. Australia, I broadly believe, is for income, and the rest of the world is for growth. And that's how we position it. So income, people can do that themselves in Australia, and I'll find the odd growth stock in Australia that fits our global parameters. So, you know, I'm not very big in Australia at the moment, other than a couple of names that fit that global growth parameter.
Given that your focus is currently on both China and the US, it would seem that the trade war would be of particular relevance to you. Are you very concerned about that at all, or do you think it's a bit overblown, or what's your view there?
I think there's tremendous opportunity in this, and I've even added some Apple shares this week to the portfolio, something I haven't held for a long time. I mean, Apple shares are down 17% this month on fears of escalation of the trade war and tariffs being put on Apple, you know, iPhone products. To me, this is a classic example, Patrick, of the market being fully informed of what is going on, a level playing field. Everyone knows about the trade war, everyone knows about the next lot of tariffs coming, and the market's very quickly assessed which stocks lose on that. So for me, seeing the Hong Kong index down 10% this month, seeing Apple down 17%, I think there's opportunity there. I've really focused on large cap consumer facing Chinese stocks. I think there will be a resolution to this. I don't think we'll be talking about the trade war in 3 years' time, 5 years' time, but I still think we'll be talking about the Chinese economy growing, the Chinese consumer growing, and growth in Asia. So what we've done in the last month is, you know, actually take up the quality of what we own in Asia. You know, really get focused on the things like Ping An Insurance, Tencent, Alibaba, the true leaders of their industries that have become cheap and just been wholesalely sold, and, you know, sold down between 15 and 20% to really quite attractive valuations in my way of thinking on a medium-term view. And also added the odd thing like Apple and increased our holding in Louis Vuitton in Paris as well. So I think there's opportunity in this. I still think the US economy is going better than anything, so we have, you know, quite big allocation to America. But I think the opportunity set in inverted commas trade war victims is pretty strong right now for medium term returns. I don't necessarily think I'll make money out of those stocks I mentioned straight away, but I think the entry points are pretty good in terms of the market paying me to take the risk. So I don't, you know, look at every headline on trade wars, et cetera, et cetera. I think that eventually it'll make common sense that some sort of deal is done, and it may not mean anything, this deal, but the markets have gone 5 weeks without any sort of positive headline on China or trade, and you can see the reaction has been, you know, quite severe in certain Chinese facing stocks. But I think there's an opportunity there. So we've been increasing our weightings towards what we think are the leaders of those sectors, the best stock in every sector in China, and we end up with three or four of them, and they're all household names, and I think they'll do well for us over the medium term. So I think that there's opportunity in it.
Well, you've mentioned there's not a lot that's kind of catching your attention on the long side in Australia, but it did seem that there were a few short positions that you had in Australia. But before we get into that, I'd be curious to get a bit of your thinking on what you're trying to achieve with your short positions, because there's different managers I know have different philosophies about shorts. Sometimes they're pairing them off, or sometimes it's based on a view of the underlying company. There can be a lot of different reasons to short. So what are you broadly looking for in a short candidate?
Now, it's interesting. I've been rethinking this a bit lately. I don't think shorting is that well understood. And I think that, you know, the risk return out of shorting is very bad. It's a very expensive business. I've got to borrow the stock. I've got to pay away the dividend. I've got to pay away the franking credits if it's an Australian stock. And, you know, the most I can make from a short is 99%. The most I can lose is infinite. So in terms of risk reward, that's the complete opposite of owning a stock. I can lose 99% and make infinite, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the risk reward is bad. You're in an ultra low interest rate environment, which means that takeovers are also happening. That's the worst nightmare you can have, is a short that gets taken over. And we've seen a few of those in Australia, actually. So the way I'm rethinking single stock shorts, we don't have many single stock shorts at the moment. I think it's a difficult environment for shorting. It'll probably remain a difficult environment for shorting as interest rates remain so low and corporate activity is picking up. But really, the concept of shorting with us is to protect your long portfolio to a degree. But every short you add is risk. That doesn't mean, there's no guarantee that a short will go down with the market. In fact, shorts can go up if the market goes down. So what I've really moved towards, if we're worried about markets, we use index futures instead on the short side, just protect ourselves from Mr. Market, hoping or feeling that our portfolio has stronger characteristics than the index itself. And, you know, we can protect ourselves a little bit there. But broadly, I think, Patrick, you know, you're better off having a combination of index futures and some cash if you want to protect yourself, and not necessarily single stock shorts. I don't think Charlie Aitken is renowned as a stock shorter. I mean, my career's been based on high conviction investing in great companies, and that's generally what we've done well out of, both in writing notes and running money. And I think that I'm reassessing, you know, the whole concept of shorting outside of index futures. I think that you may not see us do too much of that in the future.
Yeah, it certainly is a difficult game. I often tell people who ask me about shorting that I think, you know, it's probably 5 to 10 times harder than investing on the long side. So if you, unless you're very confident about, even if you're very confident about your skills, actually, there's no guarantees that they're going to translate to shorting. It's no doubt a very challenging way to make money.
It's almost a dark art. It's a very difficult business. Now, it requires a mindset and an approach and a time frame and tenure from your investors. You can be wrong for a very long time on shorts and then eventually be right, as many shorters would tell you. But at the moment, I think it's a very, very hard environment to be short, where cash rates are so low globally, interest rates are so low globally, corporates are stepping up activity. It's a dangerous, and it's always the worst businesses that seem to get taken over as well. It's never CSL, it's something else that gets taken over. That's, you know, people think they can do a better job running, or private equity think they can do a better job running. So look, I think it also, because it's such a poor risk reward equation, because you're, you know, as I said, you can make 99% or lose infinite, it's nerve wracking. It takes up a disproportionate amount of your time as a fund manager. And really, the vast bulk of money you make as a fund manager is on the long side, investing in great companies and compounding them over many years and sticking with them. So I've reassessed that. We have no shorts in Australia right now. I think that, you know, that was, thankfully we covered all shorts before the election, which was more good luck than more good management. But we also feel in Australia shorts get very, very crowded. You know, everyone was short banks, everyone was short building materials, everyone was short real estate companies. Very, very crowded on a very well-known narrative. So if you make money in a short, it's usually something that the biggest money you make is on an unexpected development, not a expected development like, you know, housing price falls in Australia. So look, I think I'm going to, you know, the way we've got the portfolio situated now is more, you know, long, high conviction long investments, some cash, and occasionally some index futures to protect us, etc. So single stock shorts, probably not me going forward.
Fair enough. Well, I wanted to talk about something that might be a bit of a difficult subject still. I don't know how it's going for you. Obviously, there was a big incident with Boeing recently, and I know that's a stock that you guys are long. You know, you never want to be a long a stock when a story like that breaks. So I'd just be curious to get a bit of insight into what happened there and how and what was your thinking. You know, what first went through your mind when you found out about the Boeing incident, and how did you respond?
Well, this is interesting. This is a good question about risk management, actually. So the first Boeing 737 MAX crash was in, I think, October last year off Indonesia. Shares went down about 5 or 10%. We actually bought more of them then because we assumed that a brand new plane with, you know, very high-tech avionics doesn't just fall out of the sky on a clear day, that it probably had to be some sort of pilot error or some sort of pilot error reaction to a system. The shares then recovered really well from, I think, you know, around $300 to $440 in America. The world got over that, assumed it was a one-off accident. 737 MAX is obviously huge for Boeing's profitability. But on the second crash in Africa, where the market was shut and there was nothing much you can do about it when Boeing shares aren't trading, we took the decision to sell our entire Boeing holding on the first day that we could. So that was around $400 American. We decided that the second crash obviously means there's some sort of structural problem here that needs fixing. It's not pilot error. Whether the pilots, you know, reacted to something, that doesn't matter, because once you've got two, it's a problem. So we sold our entire holding around $400. We still have no Boeing shares now, and they're about $350, but I will buy them back, you know, because I think at the end of the day, the industry structure is so good between Boeing and Airbus that there is no alternative. And that in Boeing 737 MAXs will fly again. They might have to rename them or something, but they will fly again. They're a huge part of world growth going forward. They're America's biggest export, and it's highly important these things get back in the air. And they will, if you look at what the FAA has been saying. So what we did, Patrick, was the first crash we bought more. The second crash we sold out completely. And right now we're just sitting there thinking about re-entering Boeing, because if they'd never crashed, and you can't really say this, but they'd probably be $100 higher than they are today. So you're probably getting a $100 discount in the share price today for those accidents. And fair enough, that was a terrible event, very sad and very, very bad for one of the great companies of the world. But it's happened before in other in the ramp up of production of other Boeing planes. Remember the Dreamliners had lithium battery fires and were grounded for many months. They didn't kill anyone, but they did have lithium battery fires. So, look, in terms of risk management, when you're a $200 million fund, you can sell your whole holding in a minute. And we did do that with Boeing, and it was the right decision. They fell about another 13-14%, but I'm strongly considering buying them back in the not-too-distant future because I still think they're one of the great companies of the world and will generate 15-20% earnings growth and cash flow growth over the next few years.
What are you waiting on there? Is it just certainty around? Because, I mean, it seems as though the cause of the crash is pretty well understood now and is probably pretty well priced into the stock. So, yeah, what would be the... What do you think might be a trigger that would have you ready to go in again?
Yeah, the timing thing's really important because, I mean, with this trade war, you can assume that the Chinese aviation authorities won't just, you know, green light the 737 MAX to go back up when the FAA does it earlier. The FAA will be the first to do it. The Canadians will probably go with them. Australia will probably allow it as well, back in the skies. But then other jurisdictions might slow it down. In terms of cash flow, though, that's a big problem is timing. So I probably want to wait for the second quarter result from Boeing, which will come up in about 2 months' time, just to see the cash flow drain off no real production, no real deliveries, slowing down of the production process. So I think I'll wait to the second quarter result, which could surprise people on how much cash drained out during that period. But you don't need to be a hero here. You can always just edge back into it. We had a large investment in Boeing. It was about 5% of the fund, and we did sell it quickly. But... you know, I just think we've got a little bit of time here just to see how the financials flow out. I don't want to be a guy who just trades every headline on the FAA or, you know what's going on on a daily basis with the MAX. But I just think the second quarter result, I'd rather see the financial damage from this quarter, which will be pretty heavy, actually. You know, they cancel their buyback, the cash flow goes, you know, down quite dramatically, and then assess it from there. So maybe a month or two from now.
How much of their sales is actually accounted for by the 737-800 MAX? Do you know off the top of your head?
Going forward, it's about 40% of their revenue. It's a serious number, right? But look, there's no alternative. I mean, the world needs the 737 MAX. We've got aging fleets, we've got growing growing aviation sector, we've got people travelling more, etc. The world needs this plane. It is a safe plane. You know, it will be a safe plane. Well, let's rephrase that. It'll be probably the safest plane on the planet after this, with the most trained pilots and the best systems and redundancies, and it will be a safe plane. And I think that's one of the reasons you want to own the shares again, is because this thing will be the safest plane in the world post these changes, in my view, and post pilot training. So, but look, the world needs a 737 MAX. There's no doubt about that. Airbus can't make up the production. And I think that's probably the most attractive thing about Boeing shares.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit big picture again for a minute. Going to get a little bit kind of philosophical with you here. What do you think is the biggest question out there that investors should be thinking about today but aren't?
Well, I can't speak for every investor, but I just sit here every day just stunned at the rapid pace of change in the world driven by technology and the rapid demise of certain established sectors and stocks as well. I think it's the pace of change, Patrick, that really might catch people off guard in terms of... What software is doing to the world, what technology is doing to the world, the disruption of this software and technology. You know, what are my children going to do for a job? I mean, I think about that too. I mean, is everything going to be automated? I mean, it's a really, the pace of change is so dramatic. I mean, it was only 12 years ago the Apple iPhone was first introduced, which basically allowed mobile internet. Well, now mobile internet just dominates the world in terms of how we even interact, how we shop, how we communicate, how everything changes so quickly. So I can't speak for other fund managers, but I will not have a portfolio that's complacent about change. I am not going to bottom fish in industries that are going the way of the dinosaur. That's not how I'm going to invest. In fact, there's a strong argument for investing more in the strong, more in the Microsofts, more in the Facebooks, more in the Alphabets, more in the Apples, because they're so dominant. And I think that argument is getting stronger by the day. And resisting the temptation to buy stocks that are under structural pressure because of this technological change is a daily resistance you have to put up. Because they look cheap, but they're cheap for a reason. They're not growing and they're under structural pressure on price and volume and everything. So for me, it's estimating the speed of change, which is just so rapid, and how quickly things evolve, and does my portfolio on behalf of our investors reflect the agents of change? I'm not going to go and necessarily short the things, as we said, that are under pressure, because they can still get taken over and things. But I think being with the strong is, and those agents of change that are really growing fast, taking a greater share of wallet of every industry is how I want the portfolio position. So to me, it's about not being complacent, not looking backwards, and trying to visualize, as I said, what the future looks like and how quickly it comes, because it's coming quicker than anyone ever dreamt, ever. And that's probably my greatest concern.
Yeah, of course, even the, you know, the king of deep value investing, who, you know, was made famous by investing in cigar butt stocks, Warren Buffett, even he invests in big growing companies these days. You won't find too many cigar butts in the Berkshire Hathaway portfolio today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we all look up to Mr. Buffett. He's the best that the world's ever seen. And I think, but you don't have to take enormous risks to have a portfolio that potentially reflects the future. I mean, a lot of these large cap US tech stocks and large cap Chinese tech stocks, they're not expensive. I mean, they've got no debt. They generally have 50 to 100 billion of cash on their balance sheets. They're generally on 20-ish times earnings. They're generally growing at 15%. And these are up to trillion-dollar companies growing at 15% per annum. So you can own many of the biggest companies in the world and still have relatively good value in them, I would argue. Most of them are buying back their own shares as well, reducing the number of shares on count. So look, I don't think you need to take enormous risks and buy, you know, sort of, you know, hotair.com to reflect the future. You can have some of the biggest companies in the world that look like very solid medium-term investments to me. I mean, if I look at something like Microsoft, I mean, which we may get to, I mean, there's a company on 22 times earnings, growing at 15%, nearly a trillion market cap, 100 billion in cash, buying its shares back, great management. World cannot open for business without Microsoft's products. Simple as that. So, you know, whether it's cloud, whether it's operating systems, etc., this is one of the great businesses of the world. So, you know, if I look out 3 years and I think, will Microsoft be a bigger company? Yeah, it could be bigger by revenue by 40%. So, I just look at daily life. And the other thing I always say to people, Patrick, if I'm presenting to an audience, look at the goods and look at the products and services your children and grandchildren are using, and ask yourself, do you own any of those companies? Because they're not Telstra, they're not the Commonwealth Bank, they're not Woolworths. They're different investments. There's nothing wrong with those investments, but look what your grandchildren and children are using, the products and services, and how they get entertainment, how they communicate, how they get educated. It's a completely different world. And if your portfolio doesn't reflect some of that, I think you're going to miss out on some growth in the future.
Well, let's put all that to the test. I know you are all about high conviction investing. So what's your highest conviction idea right now?
I want to say one thing about high conviction. It's like, you know, almost regret some days having that in the description of the fund. It doesn't mean you take wild bets. I mean, our biggest investment's 5% of the fund, and that's Microsoft. We have, you know, about seven other stocks around 5% of the fund. But they're great businesses, the world's best businesses. So conviction is to the themes I believe in, Patrick, and conviction in the company that I think is the number one or number two or both player in that industry. So I want to see a structural growth sector, and I want to invest in it, and that's the conviction I have, that it's a great company in a great sector. I think sometimes people think high conviction means you're just wildly taking high risks, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want people to think that. It just means we own around 20 stocks, not 50 stocks. But I like to concentrate our money in the best businesses in the world. And that actually may well prove lower risk than the index itself, which encompasses everything. So if I'm sitting here in 3 or 5 years' time and we own the best businesses in the world, I can look our investors in the eye and say, well, however it went, we own the best businesses in the world. So that gives me, you know, good comfort. But yeah, to me, the conviction thing is also means you need strong risk management. So if I've got 5% of my fund in XYZ and it's not working, I've got to also have a strong risk management framework where I can sell it. A bit like we did with Boeing. You know, let's not stick around here and find out the hard way that we're so smart that, you know, we're going to hold Boeing forever. That accident was a very bad development. We sold the shares. It was the right decision. Will we buy them back? So the risk management side of high conviction investing is important too, that you have the ability and the systems to cut things when they're not working and go back and, you know, think about how you're going to reallocate that capital. So to me, it's a sort of macho title for a fund, but it doesn't mean you're taking enormous risks. It just means you have conviction in what you're doing and the sectors you believe in. And I like running money like that. I don't think... No one's paying me to be an index fund. They want us to go and find the best companies in the world, invest in them, have a view, and do it properly. And I think that's what we try to do.
I wholeheartedly agree. However, I'm going to press you for a stock, though, if that's okay.
I've no problem talking about stocks. I love stocks. So conviction bit's easy.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe you're a bit hesitant to call out a single one as being your highest conviction idea, but let's go a little bit broader. Could you give us one of the ideas that you would consider to be a very high conviction idea?
Well, I think, look, I mean, the two biggest investments in the fund right now are Microsoft and Amazon. Everyone's well aware of Microsoft and Amazon, so we'll leave them alone. I think they're great businesses. I think they're structural growth stocks. But I think right now, when people listen to this podcast, I think the opportunity, you know, the opportunity right now is to increase weightings to, as I said before, stocks in the firing line on this China-US trade war that are great businesses. So for me, that's things like Tencent in Hong Kong, you know, the Chinese leading, you know, communication app, WeChat, et cetera, and the payment system. It's things like Ping An Insurance in China. It's also Alibaba, you know, the dominant online internet portal in China. So if I was increasing, or we have been increasing our weightings this week, it's things like that. And I also think Apple fits in, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast. So if I pick four stocks on prices today that I think will be turn into good compound returns over the next 3 to 5 years, based in the middle of this trade war, where you've got to be a bit contrarian. In life, you have to, and investing, you have to have a little bit of fortitude to be a bit contrarian when the market's paying you to take the risk. So Tencent, Ping An, Alibaba, Apple, all world-leading companies. Again, I haven't mentioned a small cap or anything. These are some of the biggest companies in the world. I think they are where I'd put a little bit more marginal money at the moment. So there's four high conviction ones. They will be good investments over the medium term. I might not have picked the absolute bottom. The trade war may get a little bit worse from here. I don't know. But I know they're great businesses. They're growing, they're compounding, and the market sold them aggressively and indiscriminately because they have business in China. I don't think that's a great way to approach investing, just by, you know, this company does business in China, so I'm going to sell it. Well, I've done the opposite. I think these are the leading businesses, China-facing businesses, and we've actually increased our weightings to them.
Well, that's the main part of the interview over, but we've got plenty of time left here. So I've got three favourite questions that I like to go over with every one of my guests. So we'll jump into them now and see if we can learn something new. Sure. So first of all, could you share with us something that you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, or a piece of research, anything you like, that really impressed you, that really blew you away.
Well, it was actually a documentary I watched on Netflix. We own a few Netflix because my children don't wait till 8:30 to watch a movie on free-to-air TV, surprisingly. Look, it was a documentary on Walt Disney, obviously, who created Disney, the theme parks, et cetera, one of the great entrepreneurs of our time, one of the great visionaries. It was just excellent. It went through, you know, his whole background with his brother, the risks they took, the vision they had, how they got the financing, and the success that Disney is today, obviously. And we have a shareholding in Disney. It's been very good to us. I think Disney's one of the great businesses of the world, has tremendous content. But, you know, part of what I do is also building a business. You know, you were trying to build an asset management business, which obviously is beholden to your performance. No one's going to give you money unless you perform decently or invest well. And it was an inspiring documentary. I just found it so interesting. So I always look up to people who've taken a risk, a calculated risk, and executed brilliantly. And Walt Disney, unfortunately, you know, died of lung cancer, I think, because he was a smoker, which my children took on board, which was a good part of the documentary. But it was brilliant for mine, and I just found it quite inspiring. I mean, in terms of reading, I'm a, you know, voracious reader. I read all day, every day, but mostly, you know, Wall Street Journal, FT, other individual you know, media outlets and macro advisors, et cetera, et cetera. But if I went back in time, still the most influential book I ever read was Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. And I believe in that strategy. Lynch ran the Fidelity Magellan Fund. He was brilliant. He outperformed markets for 20 years in big cap stocks, big cap franchise stocks. And his general approach was the best investment ideas you see with your own eyes in everyday life. And I so strongly believe that. That the brands, as I said before, that we use, our children use, our grandchildren use, are the stocks that you want to be invested in. They're the companies you want to be invested in. Big branded products that are selling more of their product, quite in raising prices. So best investment ideas you see with your own eyes in everyday life is so relevant today because things are changing so rapidly. I mean, if you bought Apple shares on the first iPhone, I think they were $30 and now $180. You know, simple stuff like that. He bought Facebook in the IPO, they were $40, they're $180. You know, then when they bought Instagram, etc. So to me, it's a combination of things, but I would say that that Walt Disney documentary I'd recommend to anyone. I thought it was particularly interesting and inspiring for people who take risk like me or trying to build a business like me. But I'd always recommend to people that go and get a copy of the 2001 edition of One Up on Wall Street. It's very simple. And make sure, as I said before, that your portfolio reflects the future, the products that people are using and going to use more of. So they're the two things probably, you know, lately that I've been inspired by.
That's actually the first serious investing book I ever read and probably my favourite investing book of all time as well. So can definitely concur with you there. It's well worth a read for anyone who has it.
You should get some royalties from Peter Lynch for recommending his book. But, but Patrick, I'm a pretty simple guy. I've always been relatively simple in my approach to investing. And Lynch really appeals to me. I mean, he did not overcomplicate it, did not get stuck in arrogance, did not overcomplicate valuations or he was right and the market's wrong. He simply bought great businesses, great consumer businesses that he could tangibly get in touch with on a daily basis. And he was right. And if you actually think about what's worked in the last 10 years or 5 years or even this year, it's again those great recognized global brands that are dominating their industries and continue to grow. And I think Lynch's words are as valuable today as they've ever been. So that's how I think about things and the inspiration I take. But I think, you know, there's lots of things that inspire me. It's even, you know, it's just, you know, courageous acts in the military or anything. I just always, there's lots of things I look up to, you know, but I read a vast variety of things, but those two, most recently, those two are the most dominant.
For anyone listening as well, the documentary I've just looked up is called Walt, the Man Behind the Myth, if you're looking for it. And you'll need a Netflix subscription in order to watch it.
Yeah, well, that's good. We own that. We own Disney and Netflix. So look, it's $7 a month. Netflix is cheap. Go and get one.
I agree. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Well, it's hard to think a very long game when you're 21, but this is the long game. And that if you can set your portfolio, basically property or shares, in the very best businesses you can buy or the very best property you can afford without too much gearing, I think that's the best advice you can give. I mean, obviously everyone talks about compound interest and compounding, and that is absolutely correct. You should probably do a refresher course on compound interest, which would be good for all of us. I think all of us should do that on a, you know, regularly. But I always think that there's a temptation in investing to buy cheap stocks or in property to buy something that's not quite perfect. If I had my time again, I would buy, or whatever I could afford, the best things I could own. Be less of a consumer and more of an investor. You don't need every pair of shoes. You don't need a BMW. You need to buy the best investments you can get your hands on and stick with them for the longest period you can and not be too encumbered. You know, never be forced to sell something by borrowings. So, and I also think the other advice I'd give younger people is just to average into things. Have a savings plan. You know, put $1,000 away, put $1,000 away a month and put it into something. Buy some decent shares. You can give it to me every month. I'll go and put it into the world's best stocks and see how we go over the next 20 years. I'm sure we'll do okay for you on that period. But quality, Patrick, buy the best things you can, the best, and hold on as long as you can and don't be overgeared. But you've got to start early and you've got to understand it's a very long game and try and buy irreplaceable assets, things that can't easily be replaced, things that you can't just wake up one morning and they don't exist, like the best property or the best businesses in the equity market. So that'd be my advice. I mean, wish I'd given myself that advice about 20 years ago, but it's you learn as you go. And part of what I do, and part of, I think, my role is to actually, you know, I do quite a few presentations at schools and things about investing and for young people. And I think the younger you can get into their minds, the long game that is investing and the absolute imperative to own the best things you can, the better. So even now, I've got a 9-year-old daughter who's given me some pretty good advice on stock selection. You know, in terms of she likes Nike and she likes Apple and, you know, her friends use this and her friends use that. And it's actually really good. Now, she doesn't understand multiples or, you know, whatever, but she understands market cap. She likes Disney. It's really quite interesting. And I have pretty good conversations with my 9-year-old about the companies she thinks are interesting. And she's been pretty damn good on that, actually. So the earlier you can teach them a savings sort of routine, long-term investing, not trading. No one's a good trader. There's very few people who are good traders. But you can be a great investor with conviction, commitment, and duration to the best things you can buy, both in property and equities.
Yeah, that that issue of gearing, I think, is one that often gets overlooked with property. There's a perception, I think, that property is much lower risk than equities. But when you gear it up at an LVR of 80 or 90%, that greatly changes the risk-return profile.
Well, I think, Patrick, I don't think property and equities should be compared. They're totally different asset classes with totally different liquidity attributes. So, I mean, I can liquidate our entire portfolio in 15 minutes. There's no doubt. They're the most liquid stocks in the world. We could go to 100% cash in 15 minutes. Property will take you 6 weeks, if you're lucky, to sell your house. There's transaction costs, there's stamp duty, there's all sorts of things. It's illiquid. It doesn't have daily pricing, which is its greatest advantage. But it's also its greatest disadvantage is it doesn't have daily pricing or daily liquidity. So if you are forced to sell in the share market, you can generally get out at a price. If you're forced to sell in the property market, it's not as easy. It takes time and you've got to find a buyer and the price may not be what you think. And there's a bit of price discovery. So I think the other thing to teach younger people, if I was again 21 again and not, clearly, but it's asset allocation. Now, I know it sounds too simple. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't put 100% of your money in one stock. Don't try and make $1 million out of 10 grand. Do it slowly, proper asset allocation. Property, your residential property you live in, some investment property, some domestic shares, some global shares. I'm not sure you need fixed interest, but that's just my view, not at the moment where interest rates are. You may as well own some decent income producing shares and take the risk on that, because your capital risk is not zero in fixed interest, obviously. You can lose your capital in bonds and hybrids and things if things go the other way. But I think the lessons of investing never really change. But it's a discipline and it's a long-term focus. And if you can get into people's young people's head, there is not a get-rich scheme. This is not a lotto ticket. But you can generate great wealth by compounding over 10 or 20 years. And that's very hard to tell 18-year-olds who worry about how many Instagram likes they get on their photo.
All right, well, in the spirit of thinking long-term, now I want you to put aside trade wars here, and this is not supposed to be advice. This is not supposed to be a suggestion. This is an exercise in long-term thinking, a little bit of fun. So why don't you tell us, if the market were to close for 5 years starting from tomorrow, hypothetically, obviously, and you could only own shares in a single stock, what would it be?
Oh, wouldn't my life be good if I could just turn the market off for 5 years and come back? But the funny thing was, it'd be great if... I actually think I'll answer this in one way first. You'd be a better investor if people gave you money for 5 years, didn't look at your returns, and let you be an investor. The biggest problem in funds management is this incredibly short-sighted performance thing about monthly performance, quarterly performance. I know I'm part of it, I'm never going to change it, but you run the money better without looking at it on a daily basis or the pressure of short-term performance. I really would. I mean, my portfolio tries not to reflect short-term changes, et cetera, et cetera. But this incessant desire for short-term performance is making most fund managers worse investors because they're so pressured by short-term horizons. I mean, private equity has an advantage in what they do. They take money for 5 years and give it back to you in 5 years and don't have to worry about it, don't have daily pricing. But that may never come to the funds management business, but it would be helpful to make you a better investor, getting the tenure of your investors to the tenure of your investments would be good. But it is what it is. If I closed my eyes in 5 years and came back, I'd be dramatically better at golf, that'd be for sure. But look, one stock that I feel very, very confident in that I've mentioned in this podcast, in 5 years' time, with China growing at, say, 7% per annum, population growth, consumerism, the spread of 5G technology, the broadening of the internet in China, I would have great confidence that Alibaba is a bigger company in 5 years' time, potentially double the size of it is today. It's about $400 billion market cap. I wouldn't be surprised if that was $800 billion in 5 years' time, growing at about 25% per annum, big cash on its balance sheet, thinking about a Hong Kong raising as well, Hong Kong listing. I think that is one of the great companies of the world. It's got nothing to do with Beijing or the state, and they have no ownership of it. They can still control it to a degree in terms of its behaviour if it got out of line. But that is a systemically important company for China. It's taking a disproportionate share of retail sales on a daily basis, and it is a tremendous business that, you know, that actually I think it's arguably a better business than Amazon in terms of how it actually does business and the margins it creates. So 5 years' time, shut your eyes, believe in Asia. If I came back and Alibaba wasn't a bigger company, I'd be very, very surprised. So that's one I have. I could sleep at night and turn up in 5 years, and hopefully it is in our portfolio for the next 5 years, and that does happen. So that's the only problem with daily pricing, Patrick. You tend to check the prices too much when you should come back in 5 years and see if your thesis was right.
Yes, it's a bad habit of mine that I think I share with a lot of other investors.
We all do it.
yeah, I think so. Well, look, Charlie, thanks so much for coming on today. It's been great to hear your thoughts and your insights.
Thanks, Patrick. I enjoy doing it. Look, it's still the best game on earth, even though I had a tough year last year with a few of the Chinese things going against us. But, you know, I love it more than ever. It's, you know, being able to buy the best companies in the world and having people who support you to do that, and investors, and talking to good people like you and those on the podcast, it's still the most exciting game in town. Albeit you have the odd month where things go against you, but look, I still think the future's bright, and if you buy the best companies in the world, you know, I think that the returns that we'll generate over the next 3 to 5 years will be strong. So it's an exciting time.
What a great note to finish on.
Thanks for your time.